We call the Environment and Policy Oversight Committee to order for March 24th. First thing on the agenda, we need to approve the minutes from March 19th. And Representative Saylor, would you like to move the minutes?
I will move the minutes.
Okay, Representative Saylor moves the minutes for March 19th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. And today we are going to be hearing a bill authored by Representative Reinert, and it is House File 1544. And I will move House File 1544 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. So, Representative Reinert, welcome to the committee, and if you would speak to the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I am here to talk about House File 1544. With me today is Renee Mattson. She is the Executive Director of Spirit Mountain in Duluth. And the bill speaks towards the snowmaking ability of Spirit Mountain. They make snow intensively early in the skiing season as soon as the temperatures are cold enough to make snow. The water that they use for the snow currently comes from the City of Duluth's treated water supply, and that's the key part of this bill. And what we're looking to do is, with the support of DNR, have a permit that would allow water to be drawn from the St. Louis River instead of the city's treated water supply. So I'll end my comments there, Mr. Chairman, and with your permission, ask Ms. Mattson to speak briefly to the bill.
Thank you, Representative Reinert. Ms. Mattson, if you could state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you. Renee Mattson, Executive Director of Spirit Mountain Recreation Area. This bill is very important to Spirit Mountain. By drawing water from the St. Louis River that rather than treated water supply, Spirit Mountain will have a much better efficiency in snowmaking by increasing our capacity for pumping from 2,400 gallons per minute to 6,000. And while that may not seem like a huge change for those of you who don't make snow early in the season, for us that's a huge savings. It's very important for us to be open by the Christmas holidays. That makes or breaks our business, really. So by having the ability to draw river water and have a greater pumping capacity, first of all, we not only take ourselves off of Duluth's water supply, and that frees up a lot of water capacity for West Duluth. Currently, their ability to expand in West Duluth is limited by the amount of water that Spirit Mountain takes early season. So it's important for the City of Duluth, it's very important for Spirit Mountain as far as the cost savings as well. Not only will we be able to make snow faster and more efficiently, but it saves us quite a sum of money in treated city water. And now instead of putting the money for snowmaking into water, we can actually further our cause, which is to be a four-season recreation destination in northern Minnesota. Our recently approved master plan calls for a lot of improvements to the facility, all of those really related to summer activities, and freeing up this amount of revenue really gives us an ability to do that and to further our cause and become a greater economic force for the City of Duluth. So, the system overall is very good. Rather than taking the treated water, we'll be putting actually untreated water. It'll be filtered but not treated back into the St. Louis River where it's actually eventually starting. Right now we're taking it from Lake Superior, taking it all the way across town. Now we'll just be taking it from the foot of Spirit Mountain. So it's a great plan for us. The DNR is supportive and has no objections to our doing this, and we hope for your support.
Okay, so thank you, Ms. Mattson. And did you have to make much snow this year, or was it an ample supply?
Unfortunately, natural snowfall just doesn't work for us. We have to make quite a bit, but we were open early season, and we still are.
Yeah, well, we were out there. I took my two children out there during Christmas holiday, so had a good time.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mattson, I'm a Flatlander guy, so I'm not a skier, but I just want to get this straight. Currently, you use the city's treated water supply. When you're not talking about treated wastewater, you're talking about the
drinking
water quality stuff that's already been true. Okay. And, you know, how far away from, say, downtown Duluth are you located?
We're less than 10 minutes.
But it's, I think, Representative Gardner, to your question, that the treated water is traveling a considerable distance to get to Spirit Mountain where it's made into snow, put on the hill, and then it runs back into the St. Louis River in the bay. So in addition to this lessening the burden on the city as well as saving Spirit Mountain money, environmentally it actually shortens the cycle that drop of water travels.
Just a quick.
Representative Gardner.
I just want to make sure I understood. You're talking about the taking the water right out of the river near you, makes no, it melts, it goes back to the same source.
Correct.
Okay.
And Representative Sterner.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And Representative Reinert, just was wondering, what do you feel with being open four seasons, this would create some more jobs for Spirit Mountain and the Duluth community?
Yes, it would. We anticipate another 10 to 15 jobs on a year-round basis.
Right, thank you.
Representative Junkie.
Just curious what kind of permit fee the DNR is charging it to take out of the river instead of the municipality. Are you saving money there, or what are they going to bang you with on that?
I'm sure there's some fee involved. We haven't gotten that far with the DNR yet, but I'm fairly confident it's going to be less than what the City of Duluth charges us.
Right.
And Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Your permit applicator, the statute language here calls for a permit of more than 2 million gallons a day. Any upper limit on that amount, or how do you look at the actual amount you're going to be pumping out of the river?
We won't be taking any more from the river than we currently take from the city's water supply, which is on an average basis 65 to 65 million gallons per year.
And Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of a tongue-in-cheek, but do you get to, if you filter all the iron out of that water, do you send it back up to Representative Rukavina for the iron mines up there?
If you'd like to call him.
Any other questions? Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I was a couple minutes late. I was on the phone with John Augustine, who happens to own Afton Alps in my district. And I'm just curious, he brought to my attention that this bill is necessary because you may be getting $6 million from the federal stimulus to buy new snowmaking equipment. Is the City of Duluth going to be accepting $6 million of federal stimulus money to buy snowmaking equipment?
No, we're not. The City of Duluth, we were initially included in one of the many stimulus possibilities that were floated. We were not in the city's final plan.
Well, if I can follow up then, if there was a possibility that this money would be available to Duluth, you're going to turn it down then?
No, we're not going to turn it down. The City of Duluth did not include us in any of the stimulus requests.
Okay, Representative McNamara.
So if it is offered to you $6 million to buy snowmaking equipment and federal stimulus, are you going to accept it?
Certainly, if someone were to offer it to us, yes.
But it has to go through the city, is that correct?
Correct.
It didn't come directly to them, and the city did not have it in the plan. So,
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Representative Reinert.
The city did not include it, and I think we need to clarify also that Spirit Mountain is an authority, so separate but equal form of government. You know, the city has obviously a cooperative relationship with them, and we've helped them in the past with some of their financial obligations, but the city did not include snowmaking equipment for Spirit Mountain on any of its requests.
Okay, Representative McNamara.
So is the separate Spirit Mountain Authority, which is a public agency, if I'm not mistaken, are they going to be accepting $6 million of money from the federal government for snowmaking equipment?
Ms. Mattson.
Since we haven't applied for $6 million in a request, I can't imagine we'd be getting that. No, this is a totally separate request from anything related to snowmaking. We need to get water from the river. We have not applied for any federal money.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to know if this is another example of where we've got public agencies in direct competition with private businesses. And I want to make sure that we're on the record here. If this money becomes available, if we're going to have our private businesses, Lutzen Mountain, Afton Alps, trying to compete with somebody getting $6 million of tax money that was paid for by those other businesses to help their competitors. And I think you're telling me you're not going to take it, the city's not going to, Spirit Mountain's not going to, if it is available. That's what my question centers around.
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Reinert.
Representative, I understand the point of your question. I think the best that I can do, because as we say in the military, that decision's above my pay grade. The city didn't ask for it. Spirit Mountain hasn't asked for it. If someone sent $6 million to Spirit Mountain, it's unbeknownst to us. But that's neither Spirit Mountain nor the city's intention to have $6 million come to buy snowmaking equipment. Frankly, from the city standpoint, we've got much greater needs than snowmaking equipment.
So, any other questions? Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this would be, you know, maybe for either of you, but I'm just wondering, when you got the permits, or at least talked with the DNR about them, there was a little bit of discussion earlier about filtering out the iron ore, but I was a little more concerned about organisms and other things that might be coming with, you know, not fish. I understand you'll put a screen over the end and we won't be putting fish on the slope, but, you know, other organisms that would be in the water, and what will happen to them, and how will that change the makeup of a river.
Ms. Matson.
The water will be filtered when it comes out of the river, but not treated. So it will be filtered river water. The filters are sufficient for snowmaking, and what other recreational facilities like ours use. Most other facilities actually take their water from a lake or a river or a holding pond. We're the only one I know of that actually takes it from a city water supply. So it will be treated, it will be filtered water.
Any other questions? Okay, I see none, so I will, Representative Saylor, follow up.
Actually, thank you, Mr. Chair, but I would like to ask that question of somebody from DNR. That really would be more appropriate. That wasn't really fair to you.
Sure. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you,
Mr. Jaff, if you could state your name.
Members of the committee, I'm Jim Jaff. I'm the Assistant Director for the Department of Natural Resources Division of Water. With respect to Representative Saylor's question, the water that the city is currently taking now that is being used for snowmaking would have the same sorts of critters in it. It's just that those are probably in mortality, if any, due to the chlorine that's added to the water. So I would say on a net basis, there would be a balance there. Specific to what critters are in there, that would be part of our permit review process, and we will get comments from our fisheries and wildlife staff regarding any sort of potential impact there. And it would be mitigated through the permit application process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Gaston, so basically it's sounding like there's no net loss of critters, whether they come either from, if they're first pre-processed by the city in their system, or if they're accessed directly from the river with it. If I understand you correctly, that's what you were saying.
Mr. Chair, Representative Saylor, that's correct. But without having the review of our permit at this point, I couldn't tell you specifically if there's a difference in the types of critters or anything like that.
Any other? Representative Junkie.
First of all, I don't think this is a bridge to the minnow bill, but before the DNR gets out, what's the fee you're going to charge them for this?
Okay. Mr. Jeff.
Mr. Chairman, there is an application fee of $150, and then there's an annual fee of $140 for the annual water use report, and that's the minimum fee for an annual water use report currently.
And, Mr. Chair, up to what gallonage is that fee? And is it a graduated fee depending on usage?
Mr. Jaff.
Mr. Chair, yes, it is a graduated fee, and the minimum fee goes up to 100 gallons, 100 million gallons.
Hmm.
All right. I believe that's correct.
Thank you. Okay.
So, any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 1544 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Reinert, and thank you, Ms. Matson. Representative Hornstein. Okay. Welcome, Representative Hornstein.
Hi, Mr. Chair.
And I will move your House File 1250 be recommended pass and sent to the General Register.
Thank you.
And Representative
Hornstein. Can I have a couple of amendments, Mr. Chair?
Yes, and I will move your amendments as well. The A09-0187 amendment.
Correct.
Representative Hornstein, did you want to speak to that?
Yes, please? And members, this is, I know that the jurisdiction of this committee only relates to Section 1, but since this is the last stop before the floor, I wanted to incorporate this amendment at the request of the Multi-Housing Association. They wanted to have a more realistic goal for electric car charging stations in multifamily buildings, and so this is in response to that concern.
Good.
And then, Mr. Chair, I would also like to delete Section 1.
Okay, and we'll move first the 0187 amendment. I will renew the motion that that amendment be passed. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Hornstein moves, I will move Representative Hornstein's oral amendment to delete Section 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, the reason this bill is before you as an Environment Committee, even though I would argue electric cars are certainly environmental, but we had a, well, initially, and this is just to explain to you, Mr. Chair, this is not a, something that was added in another committee that I don't like and I want taken out here. This is actually language that was in the original bill that I authored, and we're looking for some ways to incent emerging companies that build electric car infrastructure to locate in Minnesota or build in Minnesota. And I think it's somewhere down the line there was a thought about exempting this kind of infrastructure from environmental review. Upon further research, we found that very few of the kinds of activities envisioned in this bill would even fall under environmental review. So this is not needed, first of all. And second of all, it may not set the best precedent. There may be some examples and some larger facilities down the road that could require at least possibly even an environmental awareness worksheet. So we didn't want to preclude that either. So this basically just takes out the section exempting electric car infrastructure from environmental review.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hornstein. And that is the reason that this bill is brought here. So
if you still want to hear it after you take this out, I'm happy to, but, you know.
So, Representative Deal, we have a question to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm for the author. Does electric car infrastructure, vehicle infrastructure, include a power plant?
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Representative Deal. I think the two kinds of infrastructure envisioned in this bill include, first and foremost, what we would call charging stops. So these are things that you would see in a parking lot, a post with a place to actually plug a car in right at a parking spot. And so that's, you know, the one form of infrastructure. Another is an actual battery changing station. You could envision a gas station, but a place where you'd pull up, instead of getting gas, you'd actually be able to exchange a battery in a matter of minutes and then move on. And that's it comes to us from one of the prime electric car infrastructure companies called Better Place, which I can talk about in the course of the presentation of the bill. So it would just be battery charging stations and charging spots.
Yes. Sure. Representative Bill.
Well, I see that it does not include any infrastructure owned by an electric utility. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, I will renew Representative Hornstein's oral amendment that we delete Section 1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted.
Thank you. Well, very quickly, Mr. Chair,
Representative Hornstein,
since we've now deleted the reason I'm here, not in the broader existential. In terms of the bill, let me quickly just mention to you where this idea comes from and why I think it's very important for our state and for, you know, the Environmental Interests that this committee has jurisdiction over. We have had a long history in the Minnesota legislature of looking at promoting electric vehicles for many benefits. I think Representative Junkie was the first one. He passed legislation for neighborhood electric vehicles, some of which are manufactured here in Minnesota. We had some small incentives for plug-in hybrids a couple of years ago. And now the next frontier with electric vehicles are a complete electric vehicle, which, you know, we've had experiments with this in the past, even mass production in the past. The main reason, I think, that we've not had a lot of consumer interest in this is because people have legitimate questions about what happens. I'm trying to get from point A to point B. What happens when the battery runs out? Do I have an opportunity to recharge my battery? And the second thing that's, I think, prohibiting mass acceptance of the electric car is, quite frankly, the cost of the battery, which can add as much as $6,000 per vehicle, and that can be cost prohibitive. We're going to see wider circulation of plug-in hybrids next year with the Chevy Volt. And then in 2 years, we're going to potentially see some more mass production of several kinds of electric cars from Renault, Nissan. And at the Detroit Auto Show, some of the American automakers also were displaying their prototypes for electric vehicles, also potentially on the market within 5 years or so. And so to really get at these barriers, there are now companies that are being created specifically for the purpose of providing electric car infrastructure to get at the battery cost issue and to get at the charging issue. One such company is called Better Place. It was founded last year by an entrepreneur based in the Silicon Valley of California. The Better Place model envisions both electric charging stops that we envision in this bill, as well as battery exchange stations. They look at the battery as kind of like a cell phone. You rent it from them, you can sign up for different kinds of plans, a short mileage plan, a long mileage plan, and essentially they are removing that cost barrier from the electric car equation in that model. And then they're also with the charging stations, as I described earlier, this kind of gas station type of battery exchange, as well as the adoption of these charging spots, we feel will really provide consumers with a real choice and an opportunity to buy these vehicles. To conclude, Mr. Chair, Better Place has a very advanced partnership in several countries, including Australia, Denmark, and Israel, where they have partnerships with the private sector, with utility companies, energy companies, as well as the public sector in promoting this kind of model, as well as the Bay Area and Hawaii. Governor Pawlenty, in his recent trip to Israel, which is the most advanced of these models, actually visited their facility in Tel Aviv. We've been in contact with the governor's office about trying to promote this here, making Minnesota one of the first states to perhaps adopt a holistic electric car infrastructure program. Two quick comments about why this is important. Very significant in terms of the environment and reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, particularly when we get the electricity from renewable sources. And quite frankly, this is, I think, one of the main pathways to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. As a country, we export $519 billion a year overseas just to buy oil. This is a real good way to address that. And I do have one witness who has some very quick comments to make as well. But that's the end of my formal discussion of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And if you could, welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the tape, please.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ethan Fawley. I work at Fresh Energy, which is a statewide organization based in St. Paul that advocates for a clean energy system and transition to a clean energy system. This bill fits perfectly into the transition mode. We're moving forward with supporting new technologies that help us move towards a cleaner energy system, and this particularly on the transportation side of that. Representative Hornstein mentioned the global warming and gasoline dependence pieces, but I want to add one other point that I think especially for this committee, and that's on the air pollution side generally. The PCA did a report 2 years ago as part of the plug-in hybrid electric vehicle task force that showed that, especially as we're moving towards more renewable, clean energy sources, electric vehicles have the potential for huge reductions in things like particulate matter, air toxins, other air pollution sources that lead to things like childhood asthma and even increased rates of cancer. So for all of those reasons, Fresh Energy would like to thank Representative Hornstein for bringing this bill forward, and we ask for the committee's support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Foley. Any questions? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Horstein, I'm looking at the last page, 5.12 through 5.15. Correct me if I'm wrong, but talks about multifamily buildings and placing these accommodations in the garage. What about those multifamily buildings that don't have a garage? The other question that I might have is related to item two there, the single family residences. I know out in the rural areas there's a good number of residents that may have a trailer or a building without a garage and not really even have a car parking area identified. So I wonder if those are problematic. And then the third question, once again, in this whole area of global warming, which is still debatable, we see another mandate come forward. I'm curious how much this mandate will cost an average new home construction.
Okay, thank you very much, Weinstein. Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski. Let me just take your questions one by one. On the multifamily, that's a very good point. It's not in the bill, but we may envision perhaps a limited number of parking spots available in a surface lot rather than a garage. That's not in here. You know, whether we add it at a future time, I mean, it's a point well taken and may need to be included. In terms of single-family residences, I think your question had to do with the rural areas. Am I remembering that correct? And I think that's a good point. This is where I think we're not requiring every parking lot everywhere to have these. We do believe that in stores and other places where people will be traveling and frequenting, we might have a few of these stops. I would guess that one would have to use their existing whatever they would use to plug in their car, maybe on a cold night. I don't really have any thought about a mandate or requirement in a rural area for that. We're really looking at construction of new homes at this point. And the builders have told us, in terms of your third question, the builders and others have told us that this is something that is done anyway, more or less, in terms of wiring garages and such for electricity. So this isn't really an onerous mandate, or I would not consider it an onerous mandate at all, but it is something that is being done. And we've had a couple of concerns down the road. The Mechanical Contractors Association had some concerns similar to what you've laid out, and we've addressed those in the bill for their satisfaction.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hornstein, thinking in terms of how this would impact the public parking area and maybe even parking meters along the street. Electricity is not free. How do you envision somebody plugging in at the grocery store, for example, and paying for their charge?
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's a very good question and one I thought about. For example, you have the conundrum of, let's say, someone plugs in or wants to top off at the mall So that there's a cost to that electricity. Is it borne by the mall management? Is it borne by the individual store that is adjacent to that charging stop? I don't think that's necessarily the way to go. We're looking at something that's several years off. I would look at it as I think the individual who is charging should bear the cost, and there may be some ways in which, either through metering or credit card charge, those costs would be borne by the consumer. I think that's the right way to do it. This is, you don't get gas for you wouldn't get gas free from the mall if you park there, and this is really a transportation fuel in many ways. So we would really want a system in which the consumer would pay, not the business, in that situation.
Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you, Representative Hornstein, and I will renew the motion then that, again, House File 1250 as amended be recommended to pass to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. So
thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Next we have Representative Lilly. I will move House File 1493 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intention that it go to Environment Finance. Okay, Representative Lilly, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We have an amendment. Would you be...
Yes, and I will move the A1 amendment. Representative Lilly, you want to speak briefly to the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We just... this has kind of been a product of that's been open to input as it's moved through. And if you look at, like, for example, here's a good example. We've added kind of a governing body at the end of the bill, but and the, like, 1.2 and 1.3, where we've added, like, the Skinny Skiers Association, but the Nordic, they're called here the Minnesota Nordic Skiers, and the Amateur Rider Motorcycle Group, so that we're trying to make sure that we're thinking of everybody in this process. So
okay.
That's just real short.
Okay. Well, thank you. And again, I'll move the amendment, the A1 amendment, to get the bill in the shape and form that the author would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Lilly, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for moving that amendment. Again, it has been a project that's taking shape as we're moving through. It's this House File 1493 is the State Park and Trail Legacy Funding Bill. This is the State Park Trail and Funding Bill, as I just said. It appropriates money for the park from the Parks and Trail Fund, created by the passage of the constitutional amendment last fall. And many of you I see around the table have been involved in that discussion quite extensively, and so this is continued of discussion of the pieces of pie and how we're going to divide that up. And this is with regards to the parks and trails. This will be administered by the DNR. This bill is, I think, a very good bill. The person to the right of me knows it better than I do, and we'll get to her in a second. I'll just kind of pretend like I know what I'm talking about. I'm doing pretty good. It's essentially the nuts and bolts of it is the constitutional amendment, the 25-year plan. So we have essentially some efforts in those regards to vision, visualize what we're going to do with the future. You can see that the starting off on the bill, the appropriation lines are left blank. Because there's certainly ongoing discussion on, you know, how much money should be allocated and how much to go, you know, for state parks and trails and to different components. Minnesota has one of the oldest park systems in the nation and a leader with trails, the way it sits now, and we're just trying to make it even better, and we need to really do what we can to use this as a great opportunity to enhance the system. Some of the things are going to be very modern, and if you look on the bill, there's we've set some goals, and so on the, you know, for education, we're going to work on the website so that people know what's going on. I think the people, when they looked at the constitutional amendment through Mary Murphy's committee and through Chair Wagenius's committee, the discussions we've had is folks want to know what we're doing, what we're going to do with the money. They want to see results. So this bill does much of that and recognizes that. So the website was kind of a weak site or a weak problem, and so that'll be enhanced. There's going to be enhancements. These parks need to meet kind of the future needs. I mean, you can argue whether it's a good deal or not, but we're going to have, you know, enhanced MP3 players and touch screens and different things possibly in some of these parks, and so those sort of things. It's part of the goal here too is to, you know, given our, quite honestly, with our economy, I think we need to be respectful of some of the job situation too, and so Representative Hansen's had some efforts with the MCC and so we're hoping to put some of these folks to work and do some of that, so create some jobs, if you will, with the money, and then some quite a few more park naturalist folks will be out there. And one of the realities is that, you know, if people go to a park and they don't have a good experience, say they don't, you know, the bathrooms aren't open and these sort of things, are they more likely to come back or less likely? And obviously they're less likely to come back for a future visit. So that's what we're trying to achieve. If you look on, one of the things too is with on about 2.16 talks, or actually a little earlier than that, 2.12 talks about mapping. We don't have the best system of mapping around the state, so we'll work on trying to improve that with and include regional and state and, you know, beyond that, and trail and park and trail facilities. And we also, you know, realizing that the world's changing, we need to, you know, I mentioned the MP3s, but we need to think out of the box too and realize that, you know, we live in a winter wonderland, and we need to do a better job of making sure that people are out there in the winter and using our parks and trails in the winter season too. There's so much. One of the things that we need to realize, and I kind of mentioned it this morning, but probably would have been more appropriate to bring it up here, is that when you look at the actual constitution that was passed this last fall, this part of the amendment or the constitution is a little different, and words are a little different. And to be quite honest, I wasn't as involved as, you know, probably some of you folks, and certainly Chair Wagenius and Representative Hansen and others that you know, picked the words. But when you look at the parks and trails component, it talks about, uses the word support, and I think one of the things that we need to do a better job, and hopefully this bill will get its arm around it, is to, you know, every one of us around the table wants a trail or a park in our district, but we need to make sure that we're maintaining it. So, and that's kind of an ongoing concern, and certainly I think the word support was kind of, at least in my mind, and maybe they can say if that's true or not, if that was their vision, but I would argue that that's the case. I think we're in pretty good shape. We've got pretty limited opposition, other than the snowmobile people. No, they love it. No, he actually had a legitimate concern, and we need to get our arms around it, and we're open to that. His concern is that you know, we're gonna have signs, informational stuff on trails, and you know, obviously that could cause problems as people stop to read a sign, and snowmobiles pile up on each other, and so anyways, we're open to looking at that. And I'd like to pass it to Judy Erickson. She's been really a pleasure to work with, and I think if maybe she can cover, I guess I missed some of the plan part, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, you bet. Welcome, Ms. Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Judy Erickson, and I'm the Government Relations Director of the Parks and Trails Council, and thank you, Representative Lilly, for authoring this bill, and for many of you who have been a part of putting this bill together. Just a word about who the Parks and Trails Council of Minnesota is. We are a citizens nonprofit organization. We are funded through membership, corporate foundation, and private donations. So we do represent citizens of Minnesota from all over Minnesota, and we all sort of have a common thing in, that we share, and that's we love our Minnesota's wonderful system of parks and trails, and we have a desire to make sure that future generations can enjoy what we have today. So Parks and Trails has been working on the Legacy Amendment. I've been working on the Legacy Amendment for 10 years. And so we're excited that we're at this stage and that the voters passed it. The bill before you today does reflect our priorities and our vision for the state parks and trails. And there is a handout in your packet. It looks like this, that provides additional information. I'll refer to it a couple of times in my testimony. But one thing I do want to point out, and has been discussed in other committees, is that the new Park and Trail Fund is a great new opportunity, but it is not sufficient to meet all of the needs that there are in Minnesota's parks and trail systems, and we will continue to rely on other sources of funding, LCCMR, Job Bonding, Environment Trust Fund, and of course the General Fund. But the people of Minnesota have really provided us with a unique and wonderful opportunity to support and enhance our parks and trails. And we do support developing funding strategies so that Minnesotans will visibly see the results and the benefits of the new funding. And our goals and priorities for state parks and trails have been the same today as they were when we first began working on this. As Representative Lilly said, we have one of the oldest park systems in the nation, and we lead the nation in miles of trails. And I could give you a whole bunch of numbers about how many, you know, campsites there are. There's a tremendous infrastructure that we have, and that does need to be maintained. The biggest challenge that we have had in the state park and trail system is the dependence on the general fund. And if you look on page 2 of my handout, you can see those of you who were around in 2003, you know kind of what happened there, and we have never, environmental spending has never recovered, and that was one of the primary motivations for many of us in working on this new funding. But we do have a very strong dependence on the general fund, and as we all know, we're not going to, you know, the general fund is still an issue. And so that was a major motivation for our organization in working on the legacy amendment, was how do we take care of our state parks and trails? They're dependent on the state general funds and user fees. And state parks and trails, as you know, are authorized by the legislature. You authorize and establish our state park and trail system. And I appreciate Representative Lilly's mentioning the word support, because that has been our vision for state parks and trails. And we do, the bill has investments in three broad areas. One is in visitor services, conservation, education, and access, which is people-oriented. Our parks and trails are established for people to use, and we need to provide opportunities for our citizens to connect with the outdoors and to continue that conservation ethic that we are all so proud of. And so that would be on page 1 and part of page 2 of the bill, are the areas dealing with people and connecting people to the outdoors. The second major area is resource management, taking care of the natural resources. We have 261,000 acres in our state park system and many miles of trails, and we need to be good stewards of those resources. So that is the second major area of investment. The third area is facility maintenance, taking care of the infrastructure. You know, parks and trails are used by people, and we need to take care of contact space and sanitation buildings, visitor centers, campsites, picnic grounds. If we don't take care of the facilities in a responsible way, the repairs become so great, and then Representative Wagenius, you know, list of backlogged rehab becomes even longer. And so if we do a good job of maintaining and investing as we go in our facilities, it keeps them off of the deferred maintenance list and out of the bonding area. The bill in front of you is very detailed, as you can see. We wanted to make sure that people would understand what you're funding and what the goals and outcomes will be from the funding. We think it's very important that you will see measurable results. We did have the DNR review the language so that I didn't make up these numbers. These numbers were reviewed by the DNR, and they are based on fairly conservative estimates. We've added a couple of things into the mix that the DNR didn't originally have. So it's, as Representative Lilly said, it's a great starting point, and we'll be working on it more. Also, if you look at it, this will create jobs. I remember when we did lottery in lieu, when the legislature provided lottery in lieu funding, that there was an active and visible additional presence of activity and results in our parks that summer from the new funding that was provided. So we anticipate seeing the benefits. People will see the benefits of this. And that's why another reason there's a section in here that requires appropriate signage and language, so that as visitors are seeing increased activity, they know why. It's because they voted yes in last November. Also, there's reporting requirements. And then one of the other things that we have talked about, and I think this is still a work in progress, is, you know, we need to have a strategic plan for how we want to go into the future with utilizing these funds. And that's the last section in the bill on page 3. And that, if you look at that, it's very open. We want to make sure that not only people like myself and our members are engaged, but that our other citizens have input into a long strategic plan and then a larger plan. So, Mr. Chairman and members, you know, we value and we love our system of interconnected parks and trails. They provide access to one-of-a-kind scenic vistas, natural and cultural resources. They also provide opportunities for healthy and active living. And then there's the fact that they are the cornerstone of our state's $11 billion tourism economy. So previous generations of legislators and governors and citizens have done a wonderful job in creating our state park and trail system. And now it's our opportunity to make sure that that system is available to our children and our grandchildren. So thank you very much for your support.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. And I'm glad to see the strategic planning in here. And I guess specifically you're talking about a 10-year plan and a 25-year vision, which is probably a good way to put it, because you probably want to be doing the plans not too far out either because of changing circumstances as we move along. But as far as the planning, I'm wondering, I've been hearing about trails that are not all connected. Is that part of the overall strategy or plan here, is to connect the trails together? So are there a lot of missing pieces yet to the trail system? And the same thing with state parks as far as lands that are not publicly owned lands in the state parks. Is there a significant number of acres that that you're looking at still trying to obtain or acquire that are on current state parks?
Mr. Chair, members, that for state trails, I think that would be one of the things that people will want to look at. There was a border-to-border trail study that was done, I don't think it was 10 years ago, but it's been a number of years, and it was in response to many of the discussions that you guys are having now, and I think we need to revisit that trail plan and look at where the missing pieces are. There are, you know, let's see, of the 2,500 trails that are, miles of trails that are authorized, only about 1,200 are developed, and not all authorized trails are paved bike trails. And then there are about half of those that miles still need to be paved. So there is a lot of work to do within the existing trail system and connecting authorized sections of trails, finishing those, and then seeing how they connect. So I think planning would be helpful for everybody to be on board with that. And then for state park acquisition, there's 50 or 60,000 acres within the state park system that are, it's authorized but have yet to be acquired.
Okay. And Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and members, just to kind of add to your thoughts, almost every time we talk about these things, the Chair with Genius has used the word connectivity, and I just think it's a great word. I really wasn't fully sure, but I first heard it, but now I'm just totally embraced it because it makes so much sense. And one of the things in here that I'm really excited about is the mapping, and then also is that we can really do a better job of, you know, linking regional efforts and just figuring out so people can go from trail to trail. And I don't know if you know, I've been trying to ride my bike down here as much as I can, and so I come through the city system. I don't know if it'll get to that extent with mapping, but then I hop on the Gateway Trail, and you know, it's just the reality of trying to get people connected and getting it, you know, moving from spot to spot and encouraging tourism and just commuting. And but connectivity is just your question is so right on. It's just I think one of our key goals, at least mine, now that I'm one of Dean's converts on that.
So. Thank you, Representative Lilly. Any other questions? Representative Sterner.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Lilly and Ms. Erickson, just a couple of things I was looking at is when I looked at your report here and such, and I kind of remember this, but it was kind of when DNR was cutting park rangers out that we weren't getting an outdoor experience. And I'm just wondering, does DNR have some vision of maybe having some more of the indoor folks maybe coming back outdoors or working increasing park rangers? Is that kind of what the naturalists will be the park rangers?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's an excellent question. That has been an ongoing concern at the Parks and Trails Council, is the lack of naturalists. There are about 8 naturalists left in the state park system. So that would be one of the things that we'd want to do, because naturalists provide the connection between the outdoors to people.
Thank you.
Representative Sterner.
Yes, and one more question. Just on the last end of it, this is kind of refreshing, because I'm coming from local government. We have 20-year comp guide plans and such, and this is the first time I've seen more than 2 years around here, except for possible 4-year. But I'm wondering, is 25 where that number came from, or would you look at possibly a 20-year, which would match a lot of our local governments for comp guiding plan purposes?
Thank you, Mr. Representative Lilly. Representative Sterner, it's tied clearly with the constitutional amendment that just passed last fall. It's a 25-year source of money, and so it was just kind of a natural law. Yesterday, as the chair just kind of briefly mentioned, there was some concern by Representative Hawes, for example, that, you know, about a plan and, you know, as the world changes. So, you know, we're going to make a good faith effort and, you know, work with these stakeholders and different groups, and hopefully we can do a short-term thing that gives the public again some feedback, and positive feedback for the, you know, for their vote, and says, you know, so it'll have signage again, and they'll say, you know, you bought this, or you know, by voting yes, and then hopefully that'll, you know, and then having these things be accountable, and then the connectivity, and so it's being used, and but we're going to work on the plan, and that's key, I think, is to come up with a vision with these stakeholders. And but it's going to have to be changing, of course, because, you know, we don't know what the next, you know, maybe MP3s aren't the same. You know, maybe there's, you know, I don't know, some, we don't know. So.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to finish with thank you very much, Representative Lilly, for all your work on the trail system. It's very indebted to you for this work you've been doing.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sterner, you know, I'm fairly new to this, and I've asked to kind of get onto some of these committees to work on it, but there's a building full of people that have been really, I'm finding out, that have been really working hard on it, and so you might want to look down here and around the table to others, but thank you for the credit, but I'm pretty new. I'm a baby.
Okay.
And Representative Gaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lilly, two questions. One is just a quick one. Page 3 at the top talks about item 4 there, talks about rehabilitating and renewing trails in state parks and state forests, and includes hiking, biking, cross-country skiing, snowmobiling, etc., but it doesn't include ATV trails. Is that was that one left out by accident, or is there a reason that it's not included? I do see that the ATV groups are included at the bottom on the long-range planning section. So that would be the first question. Then the second question would be on page 2, there's several of them there under item 2 that I wonder, is there direct authority from the constitutional amendment to use the monies for natural resource management, restoration, protection, restoring oak savanna and wetlands, those types of things, prescribed burns, those types of things. I'm just curious as to whether that those are directly authorized in the amendment or not.
You want to take that one or not take that one? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'm glad you weren't going to ask what all these folks made like you did the other day, because I didn't know the answer to those questions in the other committee, so I was scared that I'll save that one for later. To your question, again, it goes back to the word support, and then how do you, it's really interesting to actually read the Constitution, because each item had, you know, each piece of the pie has actually different wording, and to me, support would, you know, obviously you're going to have to do some restoration to support ongoing, you know, the burns, the resurfacing of trails. Later on, it talks about, which I think is great. I mean, just coming down here, I drive over about, I think it's 3 or 4 bridges. So, I mean, these, you know, just on one, and our goal is to replace 1 or 2 bridges annually. So, I mean, to think that we're not having more bridge failure than, you know, on a whole big, you know, the nation-leading trail system, I mean, we're falling still short. So, I mean, to me, it's, the goal is to support what we have, to enhance it, to make sure that the experience when people go out, that it's positive, that they continue to use the trails and the parks. So it's, again, it's an argument. If you feel support, you know, keeping and maintaining what you have, then it's a good thing. I think it's, I don't know that it's clearly said exactly yes or no on some of these things. So that's what we're paid the big bucks to decide, I think. Mm-hmm. So
Mr. Chairman, on your other question about the trails, you know, the ATV has a dedicated account for trail maintenance, acquisition, and activities, and the snowmobile account has dedicated funding for those activities. And we're getting at the non-motorized area where there's some user fees involved, but where we are really falling behind in terms of trail maintenance. These are hiking trails within state forests, state parks, and horseback riding in those units that need additional funding. So.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Representative Duskowski. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Erickson, does the constitutional amendment limit it to non-motorized trails, or does it say trails?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it doesn't limit it to non-motorized trails. I have, the ATV Association has reviewed this, and I haven't heard any concerns. Snowmobilers have reviewed this, and I haven't heard any concerns with that language. So,
go ahead, Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Representative, and I, quite honestly, I've been leery to, you know, to get touch their funds or to appear as though I'm touching it. I don't want to open a little hornet's nest. So, I think it's better to separate, just to be separated. So, not that I totally support it.
Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lilly, I guess maybe I don't understand this well enough, but I'm understanding this is a 3/8 money, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And so I guess I was wondering, are snowmobilers and ATV folks going to have access to some of the 3/8 money under the trails category? And that's what I understood this to be.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Representative, you know, many of the trails are multiple use. I mean, they have, you know, in the summer they're a bike trail, in the winter they're a snowmobile trail. I'm sure Representative Dill can tell us more than I ever want to know. But the Gateway Trail, for example, that I rode my bike down is, you know, for running, biking, and then you've got horseback riding up in Matt Dean's area. So it's, you know, there's all sorts of different things that are, you know, maybe Representative Dill can answer it even better.
So, anyway, Representative McNamara had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lilly, I'm curious, on page 3.3, 3.4, either you or Ms. Erickson, you talk about resurfacing 10 to 20 miles of state trail. And I can't remember, how many miles of state trail do we currently have?
Ms. Erickson.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, we have 2,507 miles of state authorized trails, 1,249 are developed, 544 are paved. Not all state trails are paved bicycle trails.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Erickson, did I get it right that it's a little over 500 are currently paved trails? And we're spelling out to resurface 10 to 20. So you've designed this hopefully to be within the 25-year funding of the dedicated money. Are that the thoughts that all the trails would get repaved under this money?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, this is ongoing. This is not the major rehabilitation of paved bike trails like we need to do on some of the older systems like the Root River. This would be ongoing repaving, but not, you know, grinding down to zero and starting over. It's just, I mean, we've had problems on our older trails, as you know, with if you don't maintain them on it well, we have cracks, and things start going through the cracks, and then you have to put them on the rehab list, and it costs a lot more money. So we're trying to get at ongoing maintenance to keep them better in shape over a long period of time.
And Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it's, you know, I mean, obviously in Representative Leganza's committee, she's going to, you know, do ongoing maintenance and repair, and this is to, you know, to enhance, not to supplant.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lilly, I really appreciate the bill, and I'm glad to be a co-author, but as I've told to Ms. Erickson before, I think we are not supplanting if we put a bunch of money into resurfacing, rebuild, complete rebuilding or whatever, because we so drastically underfunded this that we need to do this, and this is something I think that folks will see right away. So I hope we're very strong in this area. I had one other one, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get on the record for sure that on line 3.12 and 3.13, the Minnesota Conservation Corps and Youth Corps, and under Youth Corps would allow the Tree Trust, which is popular in our area. That's part of the Youth Corps. Is that the understanding either from the author or Ms. Erickson? I'm sorry, I was, Mr. Chair. And
yeah, Representative McNamara.
Representative Roy, I was hoping to not get that because I was hoping you would know. If I'm not mistaken, and maybe someone in the audience can confirm, but I believe the Tree Trust, which is the local area that does help in some trail rehabilitation and work around, gets their funding, I believe, from Youth Corps.
Okay. Is there anybody in the audience that could testify to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, our intent with this language was to encourage, we know that there's ongoing conversations within the legislature on the role of the Minnesota Conservation Corps, so we wanted to acknowledge that these activities would be appropriate to be carried out by the Conservation Corps, but didn't go farther than that.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll follow up, and I'm pretty sure if I remember right, Youth Corps, I believe, is up in, like, Representative Dill's district. They operate under that name, and I believe some of their funding transfers down here into the metropolitan area, and they do a lot of work on public sector, local park and path projects, and they do really good work, especially in our area with inner city youth that aren't used to being outside. So it's a program, actually, where the government's getting involved in stuff that the private sector does that I very much support. So it's a little different for me.
Okay.
Mr.
And,
Chair.
Yes, Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm certainly open to your suggestion if we can work with you as we move along here. Sir.
Okay. And Representative Hansen. And any other questions at all? Okay, seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 1493 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intention that it goes to Environment Finance. And that is House File 1493 as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails, so bill is passed. So thank you, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Thank you. Next, we have Representative Saylor, House File 1770. And you'd like to move the bill, Representative Saylor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to move House File 1770 to be recommended to pass and to move to the General Register.
Okay. And we have down here that it's supposed to go to the state and local government, or is that incorrect?
I don't, Mr. Chair, I don't have any problems with going to state and local government, but I did speak to the chair, and he suggested that I just simply bring it to this committee.
Oh, okay. So we will send it then to General Register.
Unless
so.
He rethinks something, that was my conversation with him.
Okay, thank you. So I will, so Representative Saylor moves House File 1770 be recommended to pass to the General Register. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a small local bill, basically, that was brought to me by an organization, a Joint Powers Board. up in my district. And they're one of the organizations where several counties got together to try and save money and work on some of their expenses together. And this was the Northwest Minnesota Household Hazardous Waste Joint Powers Board. They have Clearwater County is their fiscal agent. So they do have a separate county fiduciary agent. And they're just sort of one of these little organizations that's sort of on the cusp of last year's legislation that said special districts, whether they need an annual audit every year or every 5 years. And they made some changes last year with regard to small cities and joint power boards, which is what this one falls into. And if their annual revenue is greater than $187,000, they needed to have the audit, and if it was yearly, and if the number was less, it could be every 5 years. Well, this small organization actually has an operating budget of $135,000, but they do have some other costs, which sometimes, according to some people, put them over the 187, and it depends on whether you look at the operating budget or some of the disposal costs, which they figure a little bit differently. But at any rate, they brought this to me because they were looking at experiencing auditing costs of around $4,000 every year, and naturally they were trying to figure out ways to be more efficient and economical, and they asked me to see if we could change their audit from every year to back to what it was before, which was every 5 years, again, to save them from around $4,000 of audit costs. And I'd just like to bring up as well that, as I was looking at some of the background on this, the government audits actually cost more than regular audits of small businesses because of the extra requirements that are required of government auditors, such as extra reporting, which is very strict, peer review every 3 years. The firms that do the audits have to have a peer review. So it ends up costing these small organizations, auditing firms rather, more money to do audits for these small cities, or in this case, a small joint power board. So since they were right on the cusp of this, they asked me to bring this up for consideration as a way, especially now when the counties are having so much trouble, balancing their budgets and trying to figure out ways to save money to be more efficient. This was something that they asked me to bring forward. So that's what this bill is about, and I ask for any other questions, concerns that you might have.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Taylor, renews her motion that House File 1770 be recommended to pass the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. And bill is passed. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I move that House File 494 be recommended to pass and referred to the government operations for a referral to the local government division. That's the correct motion.
Okay. Let's see. We have House File 424 be recommended to pass and referred to, we have the Committee on State and Local Government. Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and I know there are many people that want to testify, so what I think we can get through this if I'd just like to move into the DE4 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I'd like it in. I'd like to move the DE4 amendment.
Sure. Representative Hansen moves the DE4 amendment to get it in the shape and form he would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen to the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair and members, the DE4 amendment, which you just approved, was conforming this bill to the Senate changes that had happened, and with a couple minor changes in it, and it also provides for a funding source for rulemaking. So that's what you just voted on. House File 424, last week we had a short report on the critical area. Here's the actual full report in case folks had a chance to read it. And so there was a year spent on that report, and then the following year there's been a number of efforts trying to take the report recommendations into statute. Specifically, the legislation makes four changes to the existing critical area law. It directs rulemaking for the Mississippi River Corridor critical area. It directs the DNR commissioner to establish new land use districts. It provides a process for clarifying key terms, and it clarifies enforcement responsibilities for local government units. I have with me Whitney Clark with Friends of the Mississippi, and again, I think if we just start going through the testifiers, we can move through and get everybody who wants to speak, and I know there are many. So.
All right, we do have 10 people who are on the list right now, so I think what we'll do, we'll just move along through all the testifiers first, and well, I guess I would ask the testifiers try to keep it to 3 minutes, and so we keep moving along. If people have questions, if you could wait until the end of the testimony, that would be great. So for each testifier. So welcome, Mr. Clark. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Whitney Clark. I'm the Executive Director of Friends of the Mississippi River. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting and enhancing the Mississippi River and its watershed in the Twin Cities area. I'd like to speak in favor of this bill. We have been working with the Department of Natural Resources, Representative Hansen, for some time now to develop a proposal to bring before you that would make needed changes to the critical area framework, which dates to the mid-70s, in a way that's also respectful of existing land uses. I think the bill before you does that. I think the meat of the bill is the rulemaking, which will establish new land use districts. Currently, in the existing critical area framework, there are four districts that were established by the executive order. They're very coarse, and they are difficult to write standards for. So the idea here is that we would establish through rulemaking new districts that more closely follow the geographic character and the natural features of the river. And then we'd write standards that would be specifically for those districts. We think that's a much better approach, and in the study group that Representative Hansen and Senator Stephen convened in the interim, it was an area where there was quite a bit of agreement around the table among stakeholders. This would be a way to improve the way that critical area works for all sides, all stakeholders. This is, I think, other people will testify tonight about the importance of the river from the standpoint of natural resource, from the standpoint of a scenic resource that brings value to our community. And so I won't go into great detail there, but I will stick around for questions if there are any. Thank you for your consideration tonight.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Clark? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. And next we have Mr. Peterson from Audubon, Minnesota. Welcome, Mr. Peterson, and if you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Mark Peterson. I'm Executive Director of Audubon, Minnesota. We are a membership organization of about 10,400 members throughout the state, organized into 12 chapters. And we are speaking today in favor of this legislation. I'd like to speak to the natural resources of the bill and to mention, too, that our members have been actively engaged in all 25 critical area cities. St. Paul, for example, had a two-year critical areas plan task force, and Audubon was a member of that task force, attending weekly meetings. So we were very invested in the process, and our members involved also in many of the other 24 other cities where our members have been working. This critical area happens to be in pretty close proximity to something Audubon has identified as an important bird area. We have scientific criteria for that nationwide. In fact, worldwide, there are several thousand important bird areas
a couple thousand of them in the U.S. and in Minnesota. This is one of 36 important bird areas, mostly really because it's situated along the Mississippi Flyway. It's a migratory corridor for 40% of North America's waterfowl and shorebirds, an estimated almost 800,000 dabbling ducks, including 600,000 mallards, use this corridor. Migratory water birds, including loons, cormorants, gulls, terns, ducks, geese, swans, herons, egrets, pelicans, goose, grebes, and other species are also found here. And spring counts of up to 40,000 water birds have been made in Pool 2 from Minneapolis to Hastings. And over 75,000 water birds were counted just outside this boundary. So it's a very important and critical area for our waterfowl. All told, by various sources, we've identified 234 species been documented using this critical area along the river. We've also found 33 different species of warblers, including some species of special concern. I'd just like to end by mentioning that last year, Audubon produced a report based on 40 years of data showing the top 20 common birds in decline across the United States. 16 of those are found in Minnesota, and many of those are found in this critical area. These are some of our fastest declining species of birds that are still relatively common, such as in this critical area, northern pintail declined 77% in the last 40 years. Eastern meadowlarks are found in this critical area. They're down 72%. Loggerhead shrikes, 71% down. Field sparrows down 68%. Greater scalp down almost 75%. And the little blue heron down 54% in the last 4 years. So we believe even though this area is an urban area, which we oftentimes minimize for the natural resources values, as we can see and as the data points out here, this is a supreme area for our waterfowl and our avian wildlife, and it's certainly worth protection against the force of this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any questions? Okay, seeing none, thanks again.
Thank you.
Mr. Steve Johnson from the National Park Service, Mississippi National River and Recreation Area. Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Steve Johnson. I'm the Chief of Resource Management for the Mississippi National River and Recreation Area. I work for the National Park Service here in the Twin Cities. When Congress in 1988 set out to designate one of the National Park System units to celebrate the Mississippi River, they chose this area through the Twin Cities, and our park's geographic boundary is exactly identical with the Mississippi River Corridor critical area that was created by executive order in 1976. When we developed a management plan in the late 80s and early 90s for this park, we specifically chose, rather than to impose some additional layer of government in this corridor, to rely on the state local government partnership that was the critical area to be sort of our first line of defense to protect natural and cultural resources in this river corridor. And I should explain, our park is typical of some of the newer, more urban parks like Gateway in New York and some parks in San Francisco and other places that are generally urban parks in nature and generally are partnership parks where the federal government doesn't own a lot of land. In this particular case, it's a partnership between the Park Service, the state of Minnesota, and the 25 local governments. The state critical area program on which we rely to protect resources in this corridor was established in 1976, as I said, and has never been updated. It's not the way the executive order was designed. It's not built to be updated, and that's what this legislation, I understand, would do. And over the years, we've found a lot of problems associated with implementation of that, and there are some ways to streamline things that will make it easier for local governments to work, easier on property owners, and easier for the state, and would still protect all of these resources. Thank you. That's all I have.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions? Okay. Seeing none, thanks again. And next, Mr. Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities.
Good
Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson, League of Minnesota Cities. I'm actually pleased to be up here providing comments on this bill. We've worked very hard over the interim on figuring out how to craft this piece of legislation, and I do very much appreciate the work that the advocates have done to address local government concerns in the language as this bill has progressed, both in the Senate and here in the House. Environmentally speaking, we have 25 cities and townships in the metropolitan area that make up this corridor area and have responsibilities currently to do land use planning and zoning that's protective of this corridor to certain degrees depending on how the land gets classified. And this bill does not intend to make significant changes to that except to allow greater variation in the types of districts there might be. So there could be areas that right now need different types of protection than they currently have, maybe less protection than they currently have, because there are certain resources being targeted for protection. So the real goal of this is to make sure that the protections of the executive order end up in law. Right now, they exist only as that very old executive order. This puts them into rule, and we think that's the best way to do it. Make sure that there's expert testimony, public hearing process, response to comments, the kind of thorough review of science and findings that goes on with the rule writing process, we think is the most appropriate way to do this kind of pretty detailed land use planning requirements. The only comment I have that I think kind of crosses into environmental issues on this right now would be on lines 5.14 to 5.21. There's a requirement in this bill that local units of government submit their any variance, conditional use permit, or zoning change to DNR for review. And then that section, the lines I referred to, says that the state can collect costs for that review from the local unit of government. We are concerned about that because we are being required to submit it for their comments. And in some cases, it might be easy, if it's a very large project, to have an escrow fund set up for that project, and we can recollect from the proposer. But if it's a smaller variance, a homeowner asking for an extension on a garage, something like that, there won't be an escrow fund, and it could very easily be that the staff time would end up just having to be borne by the local unit of government. Really would prefer to avoid that, in particular since this bill doesn't increase the number of variances. All it does is put in statute or put in law what the current executive order requires. So it should not require any additional DNR time to review these than is done currently. Right now, we're required to submit these variances to the DNR. They review them. This doesn't change that requirement. So we would prefer that it not add the requirement that the local government either collect money or pay the money for that. The only other thing that we are continuing to work with the author on in this right now is in the section above that, there is a $500 late fee for local units of government if they don't notify DNR within 10 days of making a final action. We'll work with the author on that and the local government committees next week rather than spend time talking about it here, Mr. Chair. Be happy to answer any questions I can.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Hearing none. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. We have Mr. Townsend, Rick Townsend. Excuse me, Rick Townsend Anderson from the River Community Coalition. Welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the record.
My name is Nick Peterson of the River Coalition.
Oh,
Mr. Townsend Anderson couldn't stick around this late, so I'll speak on his behalf and add a few of my own comments. So.
Okay. Welcome, Mr. Peterson. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. We are basically opposed to this at this point in time. I guess to give you a little history of the river. The river has really been, the corridor has been a prairie and it's been a shrub oak habitat based on some of the research that I've done on it. If you look at the air photos that I handed out, you notice that back is before the critical area came into effect that it was basically, at least in Brooklyn Park, farm fields. Potato is king in Brooklyn Park, and we have actually have a tater festival to celebrate the potatoes. But it was a field bank to the top of the bank. And so a lot has changed since then. If you look at the third one, you'll see it's not a very good photo from the DNR's website. But it does show basically a a highly vegetated river corridor with trees and lawns and homes and the whole bit. So the environment has radically changed since the initiation of the critical area corridor. Some of the things that we're concerned about are basically we don't know what is going to be in this rule. About 10 years ago, we were updating our critical area plan and our comprehensive plan, and what was imposed on us, or was attempted to be imposed on us, was some very, very stringent limitations on the use of our property. We couldn't mow our lawns, we couldn't trim trees, we couldn't do a great number of things that we would normally do. And so our fear is revisiting that same scenario again. And Mr. Johnson's comment that, you know, we're merely going to just codify the executive order, that sounds good here, but when we actually get down to it, we don't know what these rules are going to entail, and so that is why we're quite fearful of this. We're fearful that we will be creating many more nonconformities in our corridor, our homes, our businesses, the activities that we do, and increasing the nonconformities actually, I believe, will probably increase the number of variances that will come in for us to do our normal landscaping, for instance. We might have to come in for a variance of your landscaping if certain buffers, preservation buffers are imposed. So that really concerns us as homeowners in the river corridor area. And the nonconformities really put a chilling effect on the individual landowners, because there's no guarantee you can rebuild your home in case of a fire or other hazard. Apparently there's some other nonconforming language going through the chambers right now that I'm not really sure of, but that may be helpful, it may not be helpful, I'm not sure, but that's always an ever-changing game. And it also affects the amount of effort that people will put into building and upgrading their properties. If they have a nonconforming property, why are they going to invest in it? And so if you don't invest in your property, you're going to lose the tax value. Another thing is, in these preservation areas, based on my experience, I tried to let my riverfront go wild a few years, and what I found was that the loosestrife moved in just above where the water was in the summer. Reed Canary tried to take over my bank, and on the top of the bank, buckthorn tried to move in. So if these rules somehow require that we have to preserve this in a natural state, well, believe me, it's not really the natural state that we might envision. We have to have some active management of our land. And so I guess we're mostly concerned about the new rules, and I haven't even addressed what is the need for the rule. Well, it's government processes, the need for the rule, make it easier, make it streamlined, and that sounds fine too, but we really haven't identified any physical problems on the ground that I've heard so far that indicate that we need to have new standards. I haven't heard of any big developments that have, you know, caused huge problems on the river. What I've heard in the DNR report was that about 10 variances a year from the communities reported along the entire corridor, 10 variances per year. And that doesn't seem to me to justify moving forward with a major rural undertaking at this point in time. So the last thing I want to point out is that we already have a process in place in our community. When the executive order came out years ago, there was a process for that. Soon after that, Brooklyn Park developed its first critical area plan and its enacting ordinances. And we've been living with that for several years before the MNRA plan came into effect, which says these voluntary standards, these Tier 2 standards would be voluntary, but as I mentioned before, they were trying to be imposed on us as a requirement. Our group got involved in that, and we developed with the city this Mississippi River Stewardship Plan. And actually, it was quite contentious to begin with, and the ordinance, and it was quite contentious to begin with. We had landowners who were opposed to the new regulations, and we were bitter enemies at the very beginning. At the end of the process, we worked together to build an agreement in our city that we think effectively regulates land usage on the Mississippi River, protects the usage, and also provides some protection to landowners. And I think Steve Johnson helped us with some of that. We really appreciate that, and that's the situation where we're at right now. any new rules that come in and stir the pot, they're going to break that trust between us and the city, and that's the direction we don't want to go at this point in time. So currently they're in the process of modifying the new comprehensive plan to reflect some different things, and so, you know, it's not that there isn't any process involved here. We've been working with government for years and years and years to build something on our corridor, and at this point in time, we don't think that there's really a good reason to invest in this major rulemaking and risk imposing new standards and risk the breaking the trust that we have between us and our city. So thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Tiedekin. Any questions? President Gardner.
Maybe you could give us a little background on the River Community Coalition. I'm just assuming from your testimony you're a homeowner on the riverfront in the Northwest Metro somewhere.
Mr. Tiedekin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. In my rush to get through quickly, I forgot to give you a few basic details. I've been a landowner on the Mississippi River since 1989. The River Community Coalition came into being during the time of the last stewardship plan and ordinance update. That's when the landowners got really mad at the city, and we decided to form an organization to solidify our direction and how we wanted to deal with things. And so we have about 120 members. We're an informal group, but we do have a budget, we do have officers, we do have meetings occasionally, but that's and we're composed of members from not only Brooklyn Park, but we have a few from Anoka and a couple from Coon Rapids and a couple from Champlin, and I think even maybe one or two from Brooklyn Center.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thanks again.
Thank you.
So next, let's see, Mr. Ken Ketter from Ketter Canoeing. Welcome, Mr. Ketter, and if you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Ken Ketter, and I'm the owner and CEO of Ketter Canoeing. I live and I have a business on the Mississippi in Brooklyn Park. I work with Three Rivers Park District and Anoka County Park District in providing tours down the river via kayak or canoes. That would be anywhere from Dayton on down through Minneapolis. I've worked with Friends of Mississippi. I also work with the Isaac Walton League and the Interpretive Center in North Minneapolis. And I am also, like Nick, opposing this, primarily as a land owner, because I feel like after we've gone through all these hassles with Brooklyn Park, that as a landowner, I've got more than my share of restrictions on the land. And if you're going to, I guess what I'm, where I ran to before when I was working with Brooklyn Park is I have a number of canoes and I offered them the chance to go down the river, because what I found out was none of the folks in the Planning Commission had ever been on the river that they were trying to govern. And so as we look at this particular bill, my fear is the same thing, is that the regulations are going to be coming as they filter down to local governments from people who have not seen the river. When we took the Planning Commission down the river, what they discovered was that the homeowners are much better stewards than they ever imagined. And I don't care if you're talking about the Anoka County area, which has got some very high expensive houses, or if you're talking Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, which are all tucked in, landowners, homeowners are very proud of their property, and it is well taken care of. And as far as the kind of restrictions you're talking of, doesn't make a lot of sense. It's like if you're going to let 40 feet go natural, you're talking in the floodplain anyway. So it's like, it's not like we can develop that section. It's always going to be land, not buildings, not structures. So just to finalize it, basically, I'm just not in favor of it as it's written now, because I feel it's going to be more government restrictions on individual owners and businesses. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions at all for Mr. Ketter? Okay, thanks again. Mr. Tony Okafor, did I pronounce that right? Thank you. Salzman. If you could state your name for the record, please.
My name is Tony Okafor, Mr. Chair, members of the House. I own a business called Riverfront Bar and Grill on the Mississippi. I am very concerned about the some of the language in the bill, one of which is the management of public lands for public and public use and benefits. I feel that that would, if this bill passes, it could very negatively impact my business. We are working with the city of Brooklyn Park that's already zoning issues and zoning regulations on the river. That's already, I think it's very adequate already. So I really don't, I am not in support of this passage today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Okafor. Any questions? Okay, seeing none. Thanks again. Next we have Mr. Lori Lauder. Ms. Lori Lauder. The St. Paul Port Authority. Thank you for joining us, and if you could state your name for the record.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Lori Lauder. I am the Director of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs at the Port Authority. I'll try to keep my comments very brief. First of all, I want to say thanks to Representative Hansen and Friends of the Mississippi River for the time they've spent with us talking about this bill. We do have some concerns. Let me first say that the Port Authority's mission primarily includes business and jobs development as well as environmental stewardship of both land and a portion of the Mississippi River. We clean up brownfields and we are working on wetlands improvements along certain portions of the river in downtown St. Paul. We have some concerns about the language here, and we appreciate probably next week or in the next few days speaking with the House author and Friends of the Mississippi River further on that. And also wanted to point out that one of our business customers, Summit Brewery, has put a letter out to you. You probably have that in your packet. So again, Mr. Chair, we are concerned about the impacts that may occur through some of the language here, the impacts on business for maintaining them in this corridor along Shepherd Road specifically. These businesses have over 1,800 jobs currently, and we'd like to make sure that they're maintained. So we look forward to working further with Representative Hansen and the other parties. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Representative
Johnson. A lot of us on this end of the table are committed to not letting anything happen to the brewery. Nothing.
Good man, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, next, Molly Grove. Welcome, Ms. Grove.
Thank you, Mr. Chair members. I'm Molly Grove, Vice President for Public Affairs with the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce. We also have a letter in your packet, so I will be brief. We do appreciate the opportunity to be here, and we thank Representative Hansen and the Friends for listening to our concerns. The St. Paul Area Chamber believes this bill will ultimately take away almost all local authority over land use district designations and regulations for that portion of their community that lies within the critical area. Specifically to St. Paul, we think it changes the rules under which the city and the Port Authority have responsibly developed and could lead to an outcome where those businesses become non-conforming. Lori mentioned the Summit Brewery letter. Mr. Stetru is also a member of ours and asked me to underscore his extreme concern about the future growth of his business and investment already made and jobs. We as a chamber and the businesses that we represent are all supportive of the river, but we're also extremely concerned about jobs and our city's tax base. We believe this bill could have a detrimental impact on cities and ask that you consider not passing it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Grove. Any questions? Okay, seeing none. Thanks again. Next, Mr. Matt Anfang. Welcome, Mr. Anfang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representatives. My name is Matt Anfang. I'm President of the St. Paul Building Owners and Managers Association. not only do we not want to see anything happen to Summit, we'd actually like to see an increase in demand and production. I think that would be good, too. We share some of the same concerns as the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce, as also as the Port Authority, as some of their customers are members of our organization. And we also appreciate the meetings we've had with Representative Hansen and look forward to future ones. We would like to see a couple of modifications to the bill that I think would ultimately garner support from my organization, but would also protect some understandings that have come down between some businesses and land uses post Executive Order 7919 that occurred with the Environmental Quality Board in the early 1980s. So with that, we'd like to, again, state our appreciation to Representative Hansen and look forward to further discussion on the bill.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the testifiers, could you tell me what the concerns are in the current, have you seen the current DE4, and I'm wondering, what are the changes you're looking for?
Mr. Anfang.
Well, what we have is a concern in the last line that says that the DNR will will enforce the critical area until the rules are, let's just look at it while I'm reading it, until the rules are, item 5.24 or number 14, until the rules required under this section take effect, the commissioner shall administer the Mississippi River Corridor critical area program in accordance with the governor's executive order 7919, published in 1979. Our concern with that is there are changes in understandings that City of St. Paul established with the Environmental Quality Board in 1982 that allow for some of the existing land uses and businesses that have invested in the corridor, have jobs in the corridor, and have potential plans for expansion in the corridor, based on agreements from 1982. So if it was enforced as of Executive Order 7919, some of those plans may be thwarted and face additional challenges until such time the rulemaking process is completed.
Representative Hansen, Mr. Chair, and Representative McNamara, and that's the next two stops. There will be the local government division and then the government operations or the state local government. So we want to fully look at those concerns and deal with those in the committee of jurisdiction.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hansen, or for the testifier. I would just recommend that if the 1982 agreements either are on public record or are written down somewhere, that why don't you make those available so folks can see them. Thank you.
With Port Authority will have them.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps to Representative Hansen. Just with a question with regards to the variances. Obviously, the legislation creates a structure where a variance has to go to the DNR. Does the DNR have ultimate veto authority over that variance? It indicates from the chart that you provided that it wouldn't, but yet if we're going to go through that process, it sounds to me like it would.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, the authority still resides with the local unit of government. The DNR provides that technical review, and they can provide the comment, but that responsibility still rests with the local unit of government.
Okay. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the DNR would not have the ability to halt a variance?
Representative Hansen. Representative Eakin may provide, Representative Loon may provide the discussion as whether it's in compliance or not, but the decision, ultimate decision rests with the local government.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. And Mr. Lockesmo, did you want to testify to that point?
Welcome. Mr. Chairman, Kent Lockesmo, Director of DNR Waters. If the department does just make comments on variances, although if we wanted to halt an action, we would have to go to district court. So that would be the action that we would take to contest a local decision, as we do in shoreland, if necessary.
Okay. And Mr. Lockett,
no, that's
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen,
We haven't done that in the critical area. We have done that with other local decisions, although not very often. It has to be a quite an egregious action for us to take that, to go to court. I mean, it's something that we don't, we want to work cooperatively with our partners because we have local government administering a state rule or a state project.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lockesmill. Any other Representative Loon?
Just one follow-up, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to Representative Hansen, I mean, are there current activities going on along the river that give you cause for concern that you're wanting to go in this direction, or is it more just to provide a more unified approach to managing that the natural resource around the river?
Representative Hansen.
Representative, Mr. Chair and Representative Loon, I think what can happen here with this bill is with the rulemaking, if you think back to 1979 and the time that was done there and the tools that we have now in terms of science, LIDAR mapping, more detailed mapping, we can bring in today's technology and look at the resource as it is rather than what it was looked at in 1979. There have been changes since 1979, but we have a better set of tools that we can use for environmental protection now with the mapping. We're giving tools to local units of government rather than dealing with defining each of these issues here. The rulemaking provides that public process and provides the science that will help people. The report that was written that included industry, local units of government, and citizens, talks about conflict being involved in the existing process. Conflict with business, conflict with local units of government, conflict with citizens who may be reacting to some type of development or some type of variance. And by providing the clarity in terms of the process, updating with the rule to get more technology in there to make decisions on sound basis, and then also having it in statute so it's not a 30-year-old executive order. The legislature is taking action here, yes or no, on whether this is needed. I think that helps out the process. I think that will help reduce conflict. And it will give the time to get this done right. The intent, I believe, was that the executive order was supposed to be turned into statute or reality of requirements shortly after it was done, and we're 30 years later, and we now have skills that we can apply to this that can help out, that I think will help out industry, and they will help out local units of government, and they will help out the citizens to hopefully reduce conflict relating to this.
I think, Mr. Chair, and I think what you said makes perfect sense. I just hope that, as this bill moves along to other committees, you'll continue to work with those groups that have expressed concerns. Because I know, obviously, with St. Paul Port Authority and the cities and others involved, I think they understand the need that they, as part of development, is also making sure that they don't do harm to that precious resource. And I see that hopefully this could be worked out where everyone is happy with the ultimate result.
In my district where the confluence comes together at Mendota, the Mindawaksin call that the center of the universe, and we have that resource right here with the two rivers coming together. Audubon talked about the benefits that we have that we may not think of with this corridor, this natural jewel that's right through our middle, right in our neighborhoods here. But also we have the economic vitality that was there. We have all these cities, our capital city, our largest city, and a number of small towns all along that corridor and townships. So there's a great deal of diversity of experience working with the critical area. In addition, Mr. Johnson didn't discuss it, but with the MNRA overlay, the MNRA, they're looking at the state to manage the critical area. If that doesn't happen, if we don't take that leadership, we could have the federal government step up and take the leadership. I think they have been waiting for a long time for us to do that. And hopefully the process that we're going through here will lead to a good result and try to make sure that we can live in harmony with the river.
Okay. Any other comments or questions no more testifiers that I'm aware of. So Mr. Lacusmo would like to step forward again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Real briefly, again, Kent Lacusmo for DNR. And since we're the ones that will be administering this and are administering this, I thought I should provide a couple brief comments to the committee. We are okay with the concept of changing this from an executive order to rule. I think Representative Hansen was talking about converting this to statute. I think originally it was to go towards rule, not to have definitions and to have this process embodied in statute, but rather in rule. That's a and that process would go through the formal rulemaking process, and whether or not it's more restrictive or less restrictive than what exists now is premature to speculate. It has to go through an open, transparent process. We do think that it would be better public policy to have a more direct connection to 103F, which is the statute that DNR works under with the land use controls, rather than keeping this in 116G. And it could be switched to there, or there could be some better connection to those. And we'll work with the author and others to towards that end. And we have a couple other small concerns that we'll address those also as this moves forward.
Okay. Thank you. Any other? Yes, President McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a couple of questions. Representative Hansen, and maybe it's for Mr. Lacusmo, on page 4.26 and 4.29 of your delete all amendment, you refer to steep slope to mean slopes of 12% to 18%, and very steep slope to mean slopes of 18%. Within the industry that I've worked in, a steep slope would be considered something steeper than you could mow on, which would be a 3-to-1, and a very steep slope would be a slope 2-to-1 or steeper. Am I right in looking at this, that this would be like potentially a 8-to-1 slope or something would be considered a steep slope? And I'm wondering about putting this in here. Do we have nowhere else in statutes these defined?
And Mr. Lacusmo?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, the way I'm reading this amendment is that those definitions from 4.16 to 4.31 are, and actually it's only the first two definitions, are used in making the preliminary map of the bluffs and the bluff lines. So realistically, definitions 3, 4, and 5 that you were just talking to aren't needed at this juncture. They would be addressed in the rulemaking and a definition defined in rulemaking. But I read this as those guidelines are just used to create the preliminary bluff map. And the preliminary bluff map is only talking about the bluffs and bluff lines. So we would be defining all of these terms in the rule process.
Okay. Representative McNamara?
So I think I understand it. Representative Hansen, so slopes less than 18% and out to 12% would not be within the bluff line at all. As soon as you get flatter than 18%, you wouldn't be in the bluff line.
Representative Hansen?
Mr. Chair, I represent McNamara. Back to items 4 and 5, I believe those are taken directly from the executive order, the steep slopes and very steep slopes. It's my understanding that's why we've got that language there.
Okay. President McNamara.
Well, I could confirm, they're what's in the current executive order, is that what you said?
Steep slopes and very steep slopes. I believe those definitions are from the executive order.
Okay.
Mr.
Thank you.
Well, I think we're getting the actual executive order.
Mr. Chairman, members, those numbers are mentioned, but they aren't tied directly to a definition of steep slopes and very steep slopes in the executive order language.
Okay. So we don't know where the definition derives from, and where that.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, the definition that I will get you the copy of the executive order so you can see this.
Yes, Representative McNamara.
Well, my point, Mr. Chair, and if I understand correct from the department, those definitions might not be in the governor's executive order to say, I think of Representative Junkie and his ag committee. I'm sorry, but a 12% slope is not a steep slope. I mean, I think it's misleading to folks. When we think of the bluff line, we think of steep slope. 12% is way, that's less than half as steep as we currently standard practice to mow. So I'm not sure I understand, and if those are in current definition with the governor's report, I'd strongly recommend they be adapted to something that more reflects industry standards.
The, if I may, Mr. Chair, member of Representative McNamara, my name is Irene Jones, I'm with Friends of the Mississippi River.
Thank you.
The executive order refers to slopes of greater than 18% as having no development, and then it refers to slopes between 12 and 18% as having limited development. So it doesn't define them as steep and very steep, but it refers to those specific numbers and encourages that development be either prohibited or limited in those areas. It does define bluff line as the point where the 18% slope flattens out. So those are all in the executive order. I don't know what steep slopes and very steep slopes are in some of the other frameworks, but I think that 12 and 18% for protection of natural areas, prevent erosion in these areas, are not unique to this particular framework.
Okay.
So that would have to verify that.
The final.
But I think, you know, there would be an opportunity to map all that and look at it more closely. The purpose of the mapping is so that if there are places that fit the definition but really are not steep slopes or are not threatened by erosion or are not bluffs, they can be removed from the map. So the idea is to have the mapping process help eliminate areas that really don't belong in that category, whereas if you had an 18% slope that went right down to the river, you might want to protect that. Does that make sense?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I understand the protection. I'm not questioning the protection. I just think the definitions could be misleading for folks that are used to seeing those kind of slopes defined differently. I understand where you're coming from. It was only in the way they were defined. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Jones.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none.
I renew my motion.
Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 424, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State, Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Mr. Representative Hansen. And with that, meeting is adjourned.